the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, President and CEO of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, Ed Verona, speaks on business ties between Russia and the United States. Mr. Verona began his professional career in 1980 as a special representative for mining and petroleum equipment manufacturer Ingersoll Rand, based in Bolivia, Ecuador, and Miami, Florida. Appointed to the United States Foreign Service in 1989, Mr. Verona served as an economic officer to the American embassies in Mexico City, Brasilia, and Moscow for 7 years. He eventually left the Foreign Service to become executive director of the Moscow-based Petroleum Advisory Forum, an industry association representing international oil and gas companies in Russia. In 1998, Mr. Verona was named Russia Country Manager for Texaco Incorporated, based in Moscow, which eventually led him to Kazakhstan in 1999 and then Washington, D.C. Following Texaco's merger with Chevron in 2001, Mr. Verona became Vice President for Government and Public Affairs for Chevron Texaco's upstream operations in Latin America. Ed Verona was appointed President and CEO of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, which includes members of both American and Russian companies, on June 1, 2008. Prior to that position, he was Vice President of ExxonMobil Russia Incorporated, based in Moscow. On Monday, February 9th, students from Chugiak and West High School gathered to hear him speak about business ties between Russia and the United States at the Alaska World Affairs Council meeting in Anchorage. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents President and CEO of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, Ed Verona.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Also, I'm very cognizant of the fact that you all came here expecting to hear the chairman of the International Affairs Committee of the Federation Council of the Russian Federation. And notwithstanding Rod's kind words, I'm afraid I was only sharing the billing. Unfortunately, he was called to Paris in his capacity as liaison for the Darfur and southern Sudanese crises. So a long way from Alaska in theme. So I am standing in. I hope I make up for my lack of specificity on the topic with spontaneity. First, I want to give special appreciation to BP and ExxonMobil, who have very kindly sponsored this luncheon. I also want to thank Patricia Eckert of the Government's International Trade Office, who set up a marvelous program for Senator Margalef while he was here, and for me during the remainder of my visit to Alaska. I also want to give thanks to the World Affairs Council of Alaska for giving me the opportunity to speak, to Rod, and also to the Executive Director, Lisa Fasco. Thank you very much. It's a quite a daunting task to try to cover the gamut of economic and political developments in Russia in the 30 minutes or so allotted to me before we have questions and answers. So I'm going to try to touch on the salient points, and hopefully you will have questions about those things that I have omitted, or those things that I have purposely not wanted to say because they may be controversial and I could be quoted in the press. 11 years ago now, the Russian ruble crisis occurred when Russia defaulted on its external official debt. It was the largest debt default, official debt default in history. Russia's GDP collapsed, and the country looked, the ruble itself fell 70%, and it didn't look to many people like Russia was going to be a major economic player for a decade or more. I was there for all of that, and I have to say I shared that view. I was in the oil industry at the time, so it had a lot to do with what was happening to the oil price. But from the next year onward, until last year, there was a remarkable resurgence of Russia's economy. GDP growth was never less than 4.7% during that period and hit as high as 10% in the year 2000. And along with it, there was a remarkable rise in per capita income, an emergence of middle class, one of the positive, very positive social developments that came out of that time. Russia paid off its remaining official external debt, virtually all of it, and then began accumulating a very large trade surplus as oil and gas prices went up, and eventually built up the world's third largest foreign exchange reserves, reaching a peak of $600 billion, just shy of it, in July. So this remarkable turnaround has produced a number of changes, a change in the way Russia related to the external environment, how it engaged with its neighbors, its relationships with world powers, including the United States, in its own self-esteem, confidence, there's been a remarkable turnaround. And that was the picture pretty much up through August. And we all know that the Russia-Georgia War occurred at that time. And you could say that that marked a watershed in Russian history. But it coincided with, and very shortly after, what became the world financial crisis, Lehman Brothers and so on. In fact, in Russia, that process may have begun earlier in May with an incident known as the Mitchell crisis involving a Russian company which was accused of having evaded taxes. And it looked to many people as though it was a beginning of another Yukos episode. And at that point, stock prices began to come down. It had a lot to do with the fact as well that oil prices were beginning to come down. Just a few statistics, some of them probably not unfamiliar to an audience in Alaska. From July of 2008 to January of 2009, the price of oil went from $142.50 per barrel to $41.90 as of the late January when these numbers were collected, a 71% decline. And since at least half of Russia's foreign exchange earnings come from oil and gas and more of its government revenues, you can imagine the impact this has had. It's only beginning to be felt. And it isn't just oil and gas. Steel, another major export, down 66%. Copper, 62%. Aluminum, 55%. Platinum, 55%. Nickel, 48%. And the one bright spot, you could say, is gold. It only went down 17%. All of those are commodities that Russia produces in large volume. The consequence of that is we've seen a very significant decline in the ruble. It has dropped about 34%. It's worth today about 36 rubles. And along with that, we've seen a significant outflow of foreign capital, beginning with portfolio investment. The Russian stock exchange has dropped about 75% since May, beginning with that Mitchell incident. And that is the worst performance of the BRIC economies. The foreign exchange reserves, which many people believe provided Russia with a cushion against any external shocks, has declined from that roughly $600 billion to today something in the range of $380 billion, a very significant drop as the Russian Central Bank intervened repeatedly to stem the decline in the ruble. Some ask, why did that happen? Well, in part because the ruble's strength was a proxy indicator for many people of the health of the Russian economy. It symbolized this turnaround in Russia's fortunes, and it was a source of great pride for many Russians. More important, perhaps, still, is the fact that Russia continues to import a very large proportion of its consumer goods and basic commodities, and that a drop in the ruble would clearly have an immediate impact on the cost of living. So there was a political motivation, too, for trying to keep the ruble within a managed exchange rate. Russia did also accumulate a significant fiscal surplus over that period of time and put it away into what's called a stabilization fund, very much like the Alaska fund, which has also helped the government to deal with some of the immediate consequences. But the concern is, again, that could be spent in ways that would not be in the long-term interests of the economy. There's a great debate going on in Russia whether that should be used as some sort of a stimulus program or whether to try to keep that in the background, a reserve to underpin the economy in the years ahead when growth is expected to remain very sluggish. There is a bailout program. Much of it appears to have gone to a handful of major companies, and in some cases it appears that some of that may have found its way back into the foreign exchange markets and put some additional pressure on the ruble. We're informed today that the ruble has stabilized. We'll see how long that occurs, or if in fact this has reached some bottom. So this bleak picture that I describe must seem rather odd coming from somebody whose primary job is to try to get people to invest or to trade with Russia. And I'm going to tell you why I think that's still something that many companies should consider before they decide, as many did in 1998, to pull up stakes and go home. Prior to the financial crisis, and again, all these numbers have to be qualified with that, we had amongst our member companies some very startling success stories. And I'm going to recite just a few of them. There are many others, but I think they give you a flavor for the opportunities that exist. Ford Motor Company has a manufacturing facility in Russia, and the Ford Focus is now the leading foreign brand automobile in Russia. General Motors opened a factory. In fact, they opened it in November. Not very auspicious timing, but a reflection of the fact that their products are extremely popular in Russia. Coca-Cola has a $1.5 billion investment in the country. It's one of their fastest growing markets. Pepsi says it is their fastest growing market. And they've invested $1.4 billion to purchase the Lebedyansky Fruit Juice Company, which is their largest overseas acquisition. So between them, Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola dominate the non-alcoholic beverage market in Russia. Procter & Gamble, they had sales of $2 billion in 2007, and sales were increasing through a good part of last year at the tune of 30% per annum, and 50% of those products were manufactured in-country. And it's not just in the consumer goods area. Boeing has a major research and design facility in Moscow, 1,500 engineers who have worked on the Dreamliner, on the Sukhoi mid-range passenger jet. They also have a $15 billion 40-year titanium purchase contract. Almost 40% of the titanium used by Boeing is sourced from Russia, and that is a critical component in the aviation sector. Alcoa purchased two aluminum plants in 2006. They are planning to invest an additional $500 million in those plants, or were anyway, until August. International Paper has one of its largest overseas investments in Russia, a JV, a joint venture with Ilim Pulp. They put, so far, more than $1 billion of investment in the country, and they have plans to invest $1.5 billion. So these, I think, help to illustrate that Russia, despite its problems today, is a country that has enormous potential for goods and services, and enormous potential as a source of not just raw materials, but of some of the more advanced materials that are used in industries such as aviation. It also has a very special importance for an industry that you all know very well, and I know, as you can hear from my long resume, and I apologize for that, it does sound like I have a very erratic career. It has roughly 25% of the world's proven natural gas reserves. It's has the world's eighth largest oil reserves. And I know from my service in the industry, many people think it is the still last frontier, that the potential in the Russian far north is yet to be fully explored, fully discovered. And it's very hard to turn your back on that when you're the world's largest importer of energy, as the United States is. Russia also borders on two of the world's fastest, or were anyway, or most largest trading blocs, the European Union and China. So it is in a very advantageous position as a trading country. It has a population of 140 million, and I mentioned some of the products they like, but what's very clear is Russians equate those iconic brand names with their material well-being, their prosperity. It defines their lives. They have a strong predilection for Western and American goods. And only one of those has to mention a few products. Levi's, that's famous even back from the Soviet period. Marlboro cigarettes. But many, many others, more salubrious, perhaps. So we expect when things do turn around, and they will, that Russia will be in a position once again to offer opportunities to American companies. There may be some other more specific ones in the interim as Russia tries to stimulate its economy through expenditure of the federal budget, much as we're doing. And I'll mention a couple of statistics. The president's economic advisor, Arkady Dvorakovich, recently said that the country needs to invest $1 trillion over the next 10 years in public works projects. That may seem a bit far-fetched today. To anybody who's been in Russia or traveled extensively in it, you understand that the capacity for absorbing that kind of investment in infrastructure is there. Roads, railroads, airports, so the needs are there. But a couple of specific projects have a very finite timeline. And one of them is relatively close to Alaska, and that's the Vladivostok Apex Summit site, where the government will invest some $12 billion upgrading the local infrastructure to meet the needs of that very prestigious forum. Also, the Sochi Olympics, Winter Olympics, will be held in 2014, and the estimated cost of building the infrastructure there is about $12 billion. Much of that infrastructure will consist of imported components, maybe even engineering and construction contracting work. So there is significant opportunity. Why do we think it's important? Maybe touching now a little bit on the political factors that Senator Margalef would have addressed. And I'll say them maybe more from the U.S. perspective. I'll try to incorporate where I can the Russian view. Our bilateral trade with Russia today is about $30 billion, or was last year. We'll see what happens in this current environment. But $30 billion sounds like a lot of money. I guess it is. But it's not a lot compared to our total bilateral trade. And it makes us only Russia's eighth largest trading partner, and we're a long way down on the scale. And that explains maybe one reason why our political relationship tends to be so volatile. And maybe think in terms of comparison. With China, we have a $380 billion bilateral trade, 10 times the size, and of course highly controversial, but in many respects. But this exchange of goods creates long-term interests on both sides. And if you can imagine, maybe you can, if there had been an incident such as the collision between a U.S., intelligence gathering aircraft and a Russian fighter, what sort of reaction that would have produced. It produced a very strong reaction when it occurred in China, but that was something that was dealt with and eventually resolved. There was, can you imagine, the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the Serbian war, the Kosovo war. That also was resolved. I can only conclude that there was too much at stake on both sides to allow those things to disrupt what was a successful relationship, provided the concerns were addressed, problems were recognized, acknowledgments made of errors. But we don't have the same relationship with Russia, not the same volumes. So I think of it as ballast. We have a vessel that every time the wind blows, every time there's a storm, we go off course, and sometimes close to the rocks. That having more trade between us, more investment, is really the best guarantee that we can have a more effective, a more fruitful relationship. But we're also facing a number of geopolitical issues that require us to have a relationship with Russia. And I don't want to go down a long list, but we've got nuclear non-proliferation, the Iranian nuclear program and what that implies. It's very important that Russia, which has is involved with the development of peaceful nuclear technology, and Iran is in the best position to ensure that that remains peaceful technology. Also, North Korea, control of sensitive missile technologies, and most, I think, pressing for us as Americans is Russia's role in ensuring the resupply of American and other allied troops in Afghanistan as part of Operation Enduring Freedom. Russia's role will be very important. I realize there are questions about the Manas Air Base, but without another means of getting supplies to troops in Afghanistan than through Pakistan, which is becoming increasingly untenable, we will be in a serious difficulty. So how can we engage Russia? What can we do to get things moving in a positive direction? Well, the U.S.-Russia Business Council has made public its recommendations to the Obama administration. One of them is that we immediately propose to the Russians the reestablishment of an Economic and Technical Cooperation Commission, what was in its time known as the Gorbachev-Chernomyrdin Commission. And that process, with all its flaws, did move the agenda. It did keep us engaged. It did create some degree of interest on both sides in keeping the relationship on a stable footing. We think that could be done again, and maybe it's a question of who would head that. We would like to see a resumption of the energy dialogue, perhaps in parallel with that commission, maybe under the same umbrella. But we are, as I mentioned, the world's largest importer of energy. Russia is the world's largest exporter, and yet hardly a molecule of hydrocarbons pass between us, occasional cargo of oil, perhaps. But we're here such a long maritime border. It seems ironic to me that there's just no transmission here of hydrocarbons between the two. And this is another step that may be in the category of symbolism, but symbolism is important, and that is that we step forward with a gesture to the Russians that shows our willingness to engage in a relationship based on objective realities and not on past issues, historic legacies. And that means stepping forward and saying we believe it's time to permanently graduate Russia from the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, maybe repeal the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. A growing number of people in Washington are calling for that. Some feel it may be a concession to Russia at a time when they don't believe Russia perhaps deserves that. But its effect has been nugatory in the last 15 years, and it has every year been given an administrative graduation. So we feel it's time to say that the conditions that led to the adoption of Jackson-Vanik no longer exist, and that it is time to repeal it. And we would then look to the Russians to receive that gesture and to respond in kind. I think there's a special role for Alaska in doing this. It's so often forgotten in the lower 48 that we share a common maritime border. And I hate to use the phrase, but you know, you can see Russia from here. It is true. On Diomede Island, you can see it. And even on a cloudy day, I'm told. And that proximity, I think, creates many opportunities to engage in the sort of constructive, positive dialogue that I think could give us some early wins, something to get the momentum going in that relationship, whether it's the Beringia National Park, whether it's creating an aviation corridor for small aircraft so that people of the same ethnic group living on opposite sides of the Bering Strait can visit each other. These are a couple of the things that I've only become aware of since I arrived here on Friday, but there must be many, many more. And I think this is something Alaska is in a unique position to do for the rest of the country. And we'll keep saying that down in the lower 48. So I've reached the half-hour point. There are many, many things that I could have said, but in the interest of getting through the ones I think are the most important, I've tried to keep it brief. So I'm prepared to answer any questions.
You've been listening to Ed Verona, President and CEO of the U.S.-Russia Business Council, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on February 9, 2009. Following his talk on business ties between Russia and the United States, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked to comment on the rather depressing demographic projections on the future of Russia.
Well, you might be a plant. I don't know. I didn't tell anybody else that I had that. I don't know if everyone can see this. Literally, I had this and I was going to talk about it. This is a Rorschach diagram. Not really. It's a population distribution chart for Russia. And for those people who study these things, and marketers do, it's a little bit too big in the middle and a little bit too narrow at the bottom. What this means is Russia is, there was a drastic drop in fertility in the country. And combined with, as you can see here, mostly on the male side of this diagram, a very significant increase in mortality. The average male life expectancy in Russia is less than 60 still, and it was more than that during the Soviet era. Reasons for the low fertility rate, the difficult economic times in the 1990s, maybe the opening up of opportunities for a lot of young women who decided to postpone their childbearing years. There could be any number of factors. The government's doing what it can to try to encourage more fertility through an incentive, cash incentive for newborns. But it's going to take some time to reverse that. But it doesn't tell the whole story. This is the average across the whole country. Maybe more significant is that the population in some of the major metropolitan areas is going up. which means that it's declining in other parts of the country, and especially in certain regions like the Russian Far East. And it's very interesting to me to observe how many young, ambitious, educated Russians from regions gravitate toward Moscow and maybe St. Petersburg, mostly Moscow. So in a way, that growth, which has been so lopsided, is pulling away the best talent from the rest of the country. It's an issue the government recognizes and wants to address. There are other issues, too, which is the ethnic composition of some of this. Very high fertility rate among Russia's Muslim population, which shouldn't be a problem, but there is a sensitivity there. So this has implications for the availability of labor. Some project that Russia's population is currently 140 million. If this trend continues, Russia's population could be as low as 100 million by 2050. I think that's a pretty drastic projection, but something will have to occur between now and then for that to change. Thank you for the question.
Since the downturn of the economy, rural communities in Alaska are struggling right now, an audience member stated. How are rural communities in Russia doing, he asked.
Well, thank you for the question. And I guess I have to say, again, I feel myself in an awkward position. I'm supposed to be here to talk up the benefits and opportunities, and I emphasize those opportunities and benefits are there, and I think what we're talking about today is a transitory phase. But having said that, one of the peculiarities of the Russian economy is a legacy from the Soviet era in which many population centers were dependent on one industry. Factory towns, you could call them, or cities, actually. Entire cities built around a single mineral resource, timber, any number of fishing communities. And as those industries are impacted by this crisis, the people who depend entirely for their livelihoods, even the heat in their houses, are in a very difficult situation. Companies that can't afford to pay, what do they do? Russia's unemployment is officially at 7.1 by the definition of the International Labor Organization, but many people believe it's substantially higher if you consider those people who remain on their jobs even when the company can't afford to pay them. Because losing your job in a place like that means you lose all your social benefits. And so that's a serious problem. That's in the smaller communities or urban communities in the regions. As far as the rural areas are concerned, they seem to be doing quite well with the run-up in agricultural commodities. There was a boom going on. I don't know how they're going to handle this downturn in which has affected agricultural commodities as well. I suspect it's going to be very tough.
Next, an audience member said he did not necessarily agree with Mr. Verona's theory that a greater amount of trade between two countries correlates to greater stability of relations. If this is in fact the case, he asked, how do you see shareholder protection rights developing in the future?
Well, I guess I put my faith in the saying that border is a transit goods, rarely transit armies. Maybe the case you cite is an exception to that rule, but by and large, where there's healthy trade and lots of investment on either side, there's less inclination to want to go to war. But that's a debatable point, I take it. Your point. As far as the minority shareholder rights are concerned, President Medvedev, in his inaugural speech, spoke very passionately about the need for rule of law, what he referred to as getting rid of legal nihilism and bringing in rule of law. He's a lawyer by training. And he spoke to all Russians who try to improve their, who try to create businesses, who try to improve their standing in life, who have now acquired property and understand the meaning of it and want to protect it. And it was very encouraging to all of us in the investment community. I mentioned the Mitchell case. That occurred only 10 days afterward. And it raised the specter of another assault on a prominent industry or company. The reaction was immediate in the stock markets. And the government then seemed to pull back from that. But there have been a number of other high-profile cases that call into question the government's commitment, maybe not its commitment, but its ability at this point to deliver, its capacity to provide effective rule of law. And that's something that has to be addressed. It's an incremental evolutionary process that's going to take a lot of training of jurists, of lawyers specialized in commercial law. It's going to take effective enforcement of judicial decisions when they are made, and that's a long process. But it's interesting. You mentioned it. We are going to have a conference in Philadelphia on the 26th of February addressing just those questions. But they are extremely relevant. Some of Russia's toughest critics today are former investors in Russia. And I don't mean in the human rights area, but I mean specifically on the question of economic reform, rule of law. So that should be recognized. I think it's recognized by many people in the government. I think hopefully that will lead to more progress in that area.
In his talk, Mr. Verona said, in order to move forward, we need to leave the issues of the past behind. How do we balance that with learning the lessons of history, an audience member asked, as we have repeated problems with Russia after World War II and more recently?
Well, I guess I could say this. As we look back to history, there's lots of episodes where we were at daggers drawn. We never actually went to war with each other, thanks to mutual assured destruction. But other lessons of history, I prefer to look at a different one and invoke that as the inspiration for a relationship with Russia, and that is Lend-Lease and the role Alaska played in the Lend-Lease program. I think it's something that could be, that should be, better known in Russia, better known in the United States. This was, in effect, our Eastern Front. We were getting goods and supplies through Russia, and I think that's one of the lessons of history. When we work together against a common enemy, we can be very effective. And maybe to take it out of the military sphere, when we work together on the space program, we can achieve amazing things. Russian technology in the space field is without parallel in so many areas, and that shows that you can get things done. As far as the importance of history, shouldn't forget. But in the case of Jackson-Vanik, which is a specific thing I was referring to, the conditions that led to that don't exist, and so that is a law that is today a fiction. It's based on a fiction. That there is no immigration of religious minorities, particularly Jews, from Russia. It doesn't exist. It hasn't existed effectively since 1995. So why do we continue to keep that on the books? Many people think it's a form of leverage for whatever purpose, but it doesn't seem to be producing the desired result. So it may be something we can do symbolically that has very little material cost.
Next. One of the students in the audience quoted an article from the Russian American Business Magazine in which the Russian finance minister said government spending goes into deficit at $70 per barrel of oil. In your opinion, she asked, what effect will the current oil crisis at $40 per barrel have on Russian government spending?
Very good question. It was one of the ones I was going to go over, but I'm glad you raised it. Those numbers have grave implications for Russia. But there's two aspects to it, and I say this because there are enough oil men and women in the room to appreciate it. One of the main sources of fiscal revenues is the tax on oil production. The problem is, as oil prices drop, it isn't a profits tax. It's a volume tax. And as the oil price drops, that burden grows proportionally, disproportionately. And that has created a situation, not back in December, where oil companies decided, we're not going to ship out of the country. We're going to send it to our own refineries because it's better to refine it and sell it in-country than abroad. Well, that meant no export tax at all, and no foreign exchange revenue. So the government quickly learned it had to address that and drop it. And that was a decision that Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Kudrin made. The other implications of it, it'd be pointless to discuss specific numbers, but it's pretty, I think, apparent that the ambitions of creating a new global architecture with the ruble as a major reserve currency is probably now sometime further off in the future. The ability to finance debt has diminished. Plans to do these major infrastructure projects, they're going to have to choose them very carefully. They can't do them all. And many other social oriented programs will probably have to be to some degree reduced. And another one that has implications for us as well, and that is expenditure on military equipment. There are some plans to expand that very significantly. The government insisted that we'll continue to do so, but that will be a much heavier burden and offsetting cuts in other areas at a time when the Russian population is increasingly demanding that those needs be addressed. So, very good question. And I guess everyone's hanging on the main question is, when will those prices turn around? And no one really has an answer. So,
can you give us your perspective on Russia's intentions in the Arctic relating to interests in resources, shipping, and security? Another audience member asked.
I don't want to say what I think, what their intentions are. I'm not entirely clear. I mean, it does seem that not just Russia, but all of the Arctic littoral countries are beginning to stake out their interests. I think it's important for us to consider that we are, amongst those countries, the only non-signatory to the law of the sea, which means that when it comes to determining how those resources are allocated or developed, we don't really have much of a say. We don't even have a place at the table. So that's something that I hope in the new administration we take up. It has implications for all the subjects you mentioned, for developing those resources, Arctic shipping, for protection of the delicate ecosystem in that region. I've seen even more alarmist talk about buildup of navies and submarine fleets in our neighbor. Canada's commissioning some new nuclear submarines, I understand. That's all very unsettling. I don't think that there's really much need for that sort of thing. It does seem it's certainly an issue that needs to be addressed. I can't, though, say what the intentions are, but it was very good PR, no question about that.
As a follow-up to the question on the Arctic, another audience member asked, how do we create the table to start talking about water issues, the Arctic, and some of the rural issues? How do we begin to create dialogue in Alaska, she asked.
Well, I guess I'm a newcomer here, so I don't want to step on toes or make statements out of school, but we've already met with a couple of organizations here, thanks to Patricia Eckert, having set up a wonderful program for us, and I'm impressed at the number of entities that have been created precisely to do that sort of thing. I mean, it seems to me that you've got the knowledge base, the cadre, to use an old Soviet term, to start on working on many of those issues, which is why I think this is an ideal place to begin that relationship. There are lots of people here who understand all of those questions here in Alaska, and those are the people who should be sitting at the table. As far as the size or the shape of the table goes on the law of the sea, I don't know. I think that's probably over my head. I'm not enough of an expert on the law of the sea to say. But thank you for the question.
BP partnered with the major Russian oil company, TNK, on a 50-50 joint venture in 2003. This company appeared to be very successful. However, last year, it was widely reported that there were some major conflicts between TNK and BP upper management, one of the students in the audience pointed out. What lessons do you think this presents for future potential foreign investors? She asked.
Oh, boy. They say, never take the last question. I'm going to say a couple things to start. One of the sponsors of this event is BP, and our hosts at Prudhoe Bay were BP. They're a member of my council, so I'm not going to say anything specific to their case because I think it's much better, something much better addressed directly to them. Now, what am I going to say in further to your good, very good question? I mean, it is a very relevant question that I get asked all the time, and maybe I can make some general observations without meaning to be very specific about the case you mentioned. But if you're going to do business in Russia, I think it's very important to have people on the ground. I think you need to do your due diligence. If you're going to have a partner, and I think for many companies it's really the only way, certainly in the oil and gas sector, you cannot do very much in Russia according to existing legislation unless you are in partnership with one of the major Russian companies, and especially with Gazprom and Rosneft, which are the only ones that can directly tender on offshore continental shelf or so-called strategic fields. You need to do your research, due diligence, know who your partner is, spend time working on smaller projects, perhaps so that you can get to understand each other better, understand the corporate culture. Russia still has a very young business culture. There are still practices there that, to our Western ways of thinking, are pretty, it's a polite term, are challenging. So that's one thing you need to do. Some companies have looked at doing work with Russian companies in third countries as a way of developing this relationship, partnership, understanding each other better, and then looking for opportunities in Russia itself, which, let's be honest, that's one of the, that's something any international oil company would like to do more work in Russia where the technology can be put to work in these world-class potential opportunities are. So, good question. I hope I'm not skirting the answer. But you can address those to the BP representative after the luncheon.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Ed Verona, President and CEO of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on business ties between Russia and the United States, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Monday, February 9th, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.